I am troubled whenever I hear someone referring to Joe Biden as Genocide Joe. Ascribing personal responsibility to the president for the carnage in Gaza is not entirely wrong, but it is, in fact, mostly wrong. The personalization takes our eyes off the prize, which is the structure of imperialist oppression on the one hand and building the broadest possible movement to fight it on the other. The president of the United States is a two-headed beast. He is the imperialist in chief on the international front, regardless of wearing a donkey or elephant pin. As such, his support for the Israeli apartheid regime, planted for three quarters of a century next to the largest oil fields in the world, is reflexive. Joe Biden, the person, is irrelevant to this function of the presidency. Should we pressure him to pull U.S. aid to Israel? Of course, but we'd have to do that no matter who's in the White House. U.S. domestic policy is a different story. The president appoints judges. We are today living with the consequences of Trump's Supreme Court appointments, like the evisceration of women's right to control their own bodies, among other tragedies. The president also appoints the heads of powerful federal agencies, like the National Labor Relations Board. On Biden's first day in office, he fired Trump's NLRB chair, a viciously anti-union lawyer, and replaced him with pro-labor attorney Jennifer Abruzzo. Without Abruzzo and Biden's NLRB majority, there would have been few, if any, Starbucks Workers United successes. Under a Trump administration, the baristas' organizing would have been slowed and probably stopped dead through lengthy procedural delays and adverse board decisions. Who is president matters for the American working class and its ability to act collectively on its own behalf. A singular focus on the international scene, shorn of accounting for the dual role of the presidency, means that the legitimate desire to stop the genocide in Palestine, if it leads to sitting out the 2024 election, can prevent us from creating the conditions for stopping future events like it. Such conditions almost always require a strong militant progressive movement, with labor playing a big role. This is precisely what has occurred over the past several months, as a powerful anti-war movement has shifted public opinion and the center of gravity within the Democratic Party and organized labor. Note that this has transpired within the political space overseen by a Democratic administration. Compare and contrast with the onset of the Second Iraq War in 2003, where a massive but brief anti-war movement crashed and burned against the brick wall of the right-wing Bush administration. What the performative enunciation of Genocide Joe misses in its virtue signaling is the practical consequence following a defeat of Joe Biden in November. Capitalist society can assume various political forms. It has demonstrated on any number of occasions that it can easily shed a democratic skin and replace it with an authoritarian one. Trump is very clear. This is his plan. When the next Gaza arises, and given American imperialism, it will, the space for a mass movement to oppose it will be tightly constrained and likely violently crushed by a police state under far-right Republican control. At a recent meeting of my East Bay DSA chapter, the comrades narrowly defeated a resolution to make opposition to Trump official policy. The vote foreclosed the possibility of the chapter working on behalf of Biden. Two of the people arguing against opposing Trump used the term Genocide Joe. One seemed to make the phrase itself his main argument, repeating it several times. The derogatory Genocide Joe enunciation plays in the same sandbox as Trump, who loves schoolyard nicknames for his opponents. Referring to Biden this way, or anyone else, corrodes political discourse and tends to end, not engage, rational discussion of the issues. Part of building a socialist movement is the modeling of socialist human relations to the extent possible within a capitalist culture. In the late 20th century, we called this prefigurative politics. It was a new twist socialist feminists gave a concept promulgated by the industrial workers of the world a century ago, when it called for building a new society within the shell of the old. Is history predictive? Sometimes. Marx's idea that history repeats itself, the first time is tragedy, the second is farce, isn't the way it always works, although it happened to in the situation he described. Closer might be Mark Twain's history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. At the very least, we might agree that while history doesn't necessarily provide a guide to the future, we ignore it at our peril. It would be in the spirit of informed suggestion rather than certainty that we might ask, what do events in 1933, 1968, and 2021 tell us about the likely outcomes of the coming election? January 6, 2021 is an easy one. Trump has repeatedly told us that he won't accept any outcome except victory. We can expect a more organized insurrection this time around if he loses. He has had 4 years to ponder what went wrong, plan differently, and stoke the resentments and grievances that fueled an attempted coup once before. Although we can't know how that will turn out, presumably security forces also learned from January 6th, what Trump will do if he wins is not in question. If he has his way, the democratic experiment called the United States will become a memory, and Trump will do his best to distort and extinguish the memory itself. Second, for someone my age who lived through 1968, it's remarkable that some people today think that installing Trump in power with the accompanying repression of democratic liberties will awaken the masses and hasten the coming of socialism. Consider the repetition or rhyme. A slice of the anti-war left in 1968, disgusted with Democratic presidential nominee Hubert Humphrey's support of the Vietnam War, believed the Nixon presidency would hasten the revolution. How did that work out? And Trump in power a second time will make Nixon in retrospect look like Eugene V. Debs. We still have time, although not much, to prevent a fascist America. But we must make the right choices based on all the factors in play, not just one issue. Hitler's rise depended on the split between the KPD, Communist Party, and SPD, Social Democratic Party. Together, the two left parties held more seats and polled more votes than the Nazis. That numerical superiority was short-circuited by the communists' suicidal belief that the Social Democrats were as bad or worse than the Nazis. Calling the SPD social fascists, the communists refused any overtures to work together. What did this lead to? 6 million Jewish dead, which became the ideological justification for the Zionist state. 50 million World War II dead in all, and German communists were the first to be rounded up for the concentration camps. Divide and conquer tactics work best when enthusiastically embraced by the divided parties themselves. Genocide Joe is a rhyme for social fascists, an insult dividing people who need to be united. It obscures the bigger picture with Schadenfreude masquerading as politics. It's tempting, I know, but please don't. There's too much at stake.